Hi, Lucy Eaton here, host of Hear Me Out. Quick heads up that the episode you're about to enjoy is a highlights reel from the full interview with this guest, so be sure to listen to the full fat version if you haven't already. And while I've got you, I wanted to let you know that we are officially now on Patreon. This means that you can invest in the channel monthly, and in return you get all kinds of perks. Just head to our page on patreon.com/podhearmeout. We've popped the link in the show notes below, and we would love to have you join the family.
All right, Giles, I'm going to launch in maybe not on the intellectual end, but I'm just going to ask you what it felt like when you won your Olivier.
Is there an intellectual end?
Well, the Hamlet bit that we're going to get onto is a bit of an intellectual end, but, you know, I'd rather start with the Starry Awards moments.
I guess what people mean when they say, you know, they sort of get up and go, I had no idea this was going to happen, and I never thought in a million years this would happen. You kind of think about it sort of on paper.
Yeah.
But the actuality of it, you kind of have any frame of reference for.
Mm.
So I wasn't thinking about the possibility of winning at all, because it was just, I had no idea what that would mean. It was very daunting before, because we worked together. I'd got the part.
You got the job, yeah.
We didn't start until the end of the year, so I was able to do the play that we did. So I knew that I was going to be able to do it. Yeah, that's right. I sort of have to work the timeline out. So before we started rehearsals, it was quite nerve wracking. But even then, they hadn't really. I knew I was going to be in it quite a way before they announced it was happening, and they swear you to secrecy, so I couldn't talk about it. So before it was kind of crazy, but then once we started rehearsals, there was no time to think about anything apart from just doing the, you know, it's like you're just trying to do the work and find out where you're supposed to stand and remember the lines and
of course
try not to get fired and all of that. So
when you say about the starry side of it, I definitely got that. Even just visiting afterwards, like I knew one other member of the cast who was Obi, who played Washington. And I remember when I came to see it, that it might have been Obi who'd put me down on stage door to, you know, come and say hello. And I'd never experienced before this sort of quite American starry, in inverted commas, way of handling visiting a friend after the show, which was, here's your little name tag, or almost you got given a little guest tag, didn't you? And it was like, go and wait on the stage and your actor friend will come and find you. And it was quite an odd I'd never experienced that in London or in England. You know, if you know someone in a play, you just sort of go and say hi in their dressing room, or they come and meet you at the stage door and you go to the pub. Whereas there was a real sort of ceremony to
it was kind of, I was, that took a while to get used to, but actually it made sense in the end, because it meant that you know all the people who were friends and family or whatever got to meet other people, because sometimes you, as you say, you just go to the dressing room and that's it. You might pass someone in the corridor and say, oh, great, well done. And then they're gone. But it was a kind of nice kind of communal thing, which I quite liked. And whenever anyone came up on stage, I don't know what you felt, but people felt like they were always like, oh my gosh, it seems so much smaller
than it looks 100%.
From the auditorium. And
being
up on the stage and seeing all of the stairs and all of that, and it's cool. It was nice. I thought it was a nice touch.
So I was going to ask this much later, but seeing as we've just had a lovely little impromptu chat about Hamilton, before we move on to The Bard, what is your incredible sounding book that's coming out this summer?
The book I've got coming out is called Hamilton and Me, and it's essentially a work journal that I kept during the production of Hamilton. Once I got the job, I started keeping a journal. And then when we got to rehearsals, which I usually do in rehearsals, I usually keep, especially if I'm traveling anywhere or if the job is touring, you know, internationally.
Like
or whatever,
a holiday diary.
And I'm going to interesting places and stuff. I usually keep a journal. And so with Hamilton, I did. I started keeping my journal from the beginning of rehearsals and then kept it all the way through the year. So the book is essentially the first bit of it, which is auditioning, getting the job, preparing for the role, going through auditions, it was like a month and a half, and then all of previews, which is quite a long preview period, and then up until opening.
I've never kept a diary like you're describing, a sort of show diary specifically, but I've actually written a diary since I was about 12, and it's almost every day. And I always think, you know, any account of anything is biased. You know, any account of anything has an element of untruth because it's being seen through that person's eyes. But sometimes I look back at them and I think that is the closest to an accurate memory I could have of that day or that event or that moment, you know, that breakup or that moment of elation, that job, because I wrote that on the day.
Yes.
So it's still got, you know, there's issues there. It's still got biases and untruths maybe, and my way of looking at stuff, but it is a memory from that moment. And it's so true what you say that, you know, in the future, you sometimes look back and go, God, I can't even remember that day. That obviously that moment really hit me. I don't even remember it happening. So what a magical thing to actually find you've got.
And it's also the thing of when I, or, you know, you look back and you go, oh, I'd forgotten that moment. So if I were in an interview and having to talk to you about Hamilton, I might have completely forgotten that. I would never have mentioned that. When you look at, of course, that happened. I felt that, or that tiny detail.
Yeah.
And part of it was, I didn't necessarily write it to be published. I just wrote it for my own process. But it's sort of useful to be as unfiltered as possible in doing it. Just literally write. And also, this wasn't time. It wasn't time. You know, I'd write it like maybe a little bit on a tea break, and also I'm writing down like what my moves are and what I'm supposed to be doing. It's a note thing. So you kind of just grab it where you can, or on the train on the way home, or, you know. So it was very much just to put down what I was experiencing and what I was supposed to be doing. And but then, having taken a step back during this summer, I found it quite interesting, so I showed it to my agent. She said, can I have a look at it? I showed it to her. And we found a great publisher. And I hope people can enjoy it and find it useful.
From Lin-Manuel Miranda to Willie Shacks, you actually wanted to talk about a lost speech from Hamlet.
I'm not sure who told me about it. I did a production of Hamlet at the National, I want to say maybe 2010. Rory Kinnear was Hamlet.
Yeah.
Claire Higgins was, there was a, it was an amazing cast. Claire Higgins was Gertrude. I was Horatio. Anyway, like going into this production, and maybe it was in my research of the, I think it probably was in my research for the play, I discovered that in one of the quartos, there is a scene which takes place between Horatio and Gertrude. Hamlet has been sent off to England with Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. Before he comes back, there is a scene where, and I was like dumbfounded by this. I was like, what the hell is this? Where, because this does not happen. There is no scene between Gertrude and Napoleon. There's no scene between Gertrude and Horatio. And he says, listen, and he tells her crucially about Claudius.
Yeah.
Tells about Hamlet's murder sentence and that it's from Claudius. Yeah. So for me, it was really fascinating because it means that Gertrude goes into the whole end of the play knowing, or at least suspecting, that Claudius is what he is.
Yeah.
So anyway, I went and in rehearsals, I told this to Claire Higgins, who was who was playing Gertrude.
Yeah.
And she's just it fucking brilliant, absolutely brilliant. We've got to do it. Show it to me. Because it's amazing for her. It has a whole
makes so much sense of
energy
stuff
to the end of the play for her. Right. And so she said, okay, leave it to me. I'm gonna ask Nick. I'm gonna tell Nick we have to put this in. And she asked Nick and he said, absolutely not.
What a party pooper.
So we never got to do it, but it was amazing. It was amazing because I don't know if you've ever heard of that. I'd never heard of this.
No, never in a million
this
years.
Moment
no.
Which takes place.
Can you explain that for anyone who doesn't understand the difference between quarto and folio?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Very good. So if you go to a bookshop now and get any copy of a Shakespeare play, you're going to get Hamlet. You will be reading the play as it was published in the first folio, which is two of Shakespeare's contemporaries who were in his company that performed all these plays, went around after his death, John Hemmings and Henry Condell, and they went around, they were in the original company, and they, after Shakespeare's death, they went around and found all of the versions of the plays, because the plays weren't published in Shakespeare's lifetime. Mm. The actors had them, the theatre would have them, and then that was it.
Yeah.
So they didn't exist. You couldn't buy the play. What you could do is people would go around the theatres, like with the equivalent of a dictaphone or an iPhone, and they would transcribe as the play was happening. They'd write down what the play was, like a bootleg version. Those are called the quartos, because they would publish them in these huge sheets of paper that would be folded in four. So you could buy those in Shakespeare's day, but they were kind of bastardized versions, very inaccurate versions. But I didn't understand where a whole speech would come from, a whole scene would come from.
Yeah.
I was like, well, either that scene, the person saw that, or they didn't. So maybe it was something that was cut, I don't know.
But I feel like that does happen all the time in Shakespeare. Maybe there are these lost scenes, because there's so many. I mean, unfortunately, it is classically the female characters, but it's like Hermione at the end of A Winter's Tale, and in another episode, I'm talking to Maddie Hill, and she's talking about when she did Imogen, which was a version of Cymbeline, and she says of Imogen that in the original version of Cymbeline, Imogen just stops talking. It sort of doesn't make sense of some of her actions. Mm. So there are all these places in Shakespearean plays where I think really necessary and helpful information is not really there to help understand why a character suddenly changes tack.
Yeah. I think it's really interesting to not take the version that you're going to go out into the bookshop and buy as gospel. There's been a whole long history of these plays being edited and cut and changed. You know, there's instances of what play was it? I think it was like Lear, where for like the whole of the 19th century, it had a happy ending or something.
Gosh.
Where they sort of, someone does a version of it. And then they sort of changed the Victorians, because, you know, they didn't want a lot of blood and a lot of sex and violence and stuff. So they changed a lot of the play. I mean, even in things like, if you take a play which, say like a late play, which was very well documented and probably in the first folio they got very easily, you've still got each editor of each publishing house putting their own editing in, putting their own punctuation in. So it's always good, I think, to go back and rediscover. You find interesting things.